WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Noah Lechtenstein with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, July 31st. Sarasota County Schools will be adding girls' high school flag football along with both boys' and girls' middle school flag football in the upcoming school year. Starting in spring 2027, all traditional public high schools in Sarasota County will offer girls' flag football, and they will compete through the Florida High School Athletic Association. Flag football has been on the rise nationally as the NFL hosts annual tournaments for youth players. The most recent girls' high school championship game garnered over 1 million views on ABC. Girls' and boys' middle school flag football will also start in the spring of 2027. The number of cyclosporiasis cases across the Suncoast region have continued to rise. According to Florida Department of Health data released yesterday, Sarasota County now has 4 reported cases, while Manatee County has 6. The data does not include cases after July 25th. The foodborne infection leads to severe or explosive diarrhea, with symptoms showing up between 2 days and a couple of weeks. The symptoms usually go away after up to a month, and in some cases, they can come back if the illness is not treated properly. According to the CDC, the best way to avoid the disease is to avoid foods linked to outbreaks and thoroughly wash fruits and vegetables before eating, cutting, or cooking. In-person voting starts on Saturday, August 8th, for the August 18th primary election. Every day from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., Sarasota County residents will be able to go in person and vote early for the primary election. Early in-person voting ends Sunday, August 16th. There will be 6 early voting sites through Sarasota County, including the Supervisor of Elections offices for Sarasota, Northport, and Venice. You can find more locations and your sample ballot by visiting sarasotavotes.gov. Over 17,000 gallons of sewage spilled at a development close to the Manatee River, the Bradenton Herald reports. The spill happened on July 8th and was caused when a county-operated wastewater pipe broke inside a developing gated community. The pipe was built over 20 years ago. Manatee County officials stated they don't know what caused it. Around 8,000 gallons of the waste were able to be recovered, although almost 10,000 of it entered into 2 stormwater retention ponds and then eventually flowed into the Manatee River. The county said that the results of a July 10th water quality test showed minimal impacts to the river. This has been Noah Lechtenstein with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, July 31st.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of 1 real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who with the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. While take 2 of the White House Correspondents' Dinner was not interrupted by any shooting, it was the scene of a bombing. That is the only way to describe the Orange Menace of Palm Beach's attempt at humor that fell flat. Is it a good thing for somebody telling jokes to be met with stunned silence? Meanwhile, the war in Iran is still raging, although it has been deemed won nearly 40 times since it was arbitrarily started. Benjamin Netanyahu was in Washington apparently hoping to mend his relationship with the U.S. after convincing Trump to start said ill-conceived war. And the reflecting pool is still broke. Desperate to change the outcome of the midterms and realizing the electorate at large is not on their side, the president and his pals are working hard to find ways to manipulate who gets to vote. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Manny Ramirez, co-chair of the Tampa chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, who refutes the categorization that socialists are the same as communists, which is emerging as a popular talking point for Republicans across the country. But first, we've all heard what a drain on resources proposed AI data centers will be. Now the EPA is giving them the okay to pollute power sources providing electricity only to data centers and not to the public grid may not be subjects to federal pollution laws, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency said this week. The EPA said that if power plants are not supplying electricity to the grid, then they would not be subject to the federal Clean Air Act's acid rain program, which has been key to dramatic reduction of smog and soot pollution from industrial facilities. The EPA believes that considering the plain text of these definitions, the acid rain program does not apply to power generation facilities that are not connected in any way to the larger grid, EPA Assistant Administrator Aaron Szabo wrote in a July 16th letter. The agency said its interpretation of federal pollution laws would speed the development of artificial intelligence infrastructure while reducing strain on regional electric grids. The EPA said its guidance clarifies that the acid rain program does not apply to so-called islanded power generation facilities that operate separately from the broader grid. The agency said that the interpretation would give developers greater flexibility in where and how quickly they can build new data centers, which are driving a surge in electricity demand across the United States. The agency said its action supports President Donald Trump's ratepayer protection pledge, which was expanded last week and requires participating companies to build, procure, or pay for all energy needed to power their facilities and associated infrastructure. Under the non-binding pledge, developers, utilities, and state regulators are expected to bear the costs associated with new projects rather than passing them on to residential customers. Air and water are not the only parts of the environment left unprotected. Animals, too, are endangered. Florida manatees and panthers are suddenly much more vulnerable, environmentalists say, thanks to the Trump administration's recently announced rollback of Endangered Species Act protections. Now, Florida Democrats are calling on Secretary of Interior Doug Burgum and Secretary of Commerce Howard Lutnick to immediately withdraw their agency's final blanket rule, which they say would eliminate protections for threatened species and revise critical habitat exclusions. The Departments of Interior and Commerce rescinded the definition of harm under the Endangered Species Act in a rule published earlier this month that prompted four Democratic members of Congress this week to write a letter to Burgum and Lutnick that removing habitat modification and degradation from the long-held definition of harm amounts to an endorsement of habitat degradation. Given that habitat loss is the leading cause of species extinction, the rule is in direct opposition to the ESA's stated purpose to provide a means whereby the ecosystems upon which endangered species and threatened species depend may be conserved. A key component for the conservation of species themselves, says the letter written by Democrats Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Kathy Castor, Darren Soto, and Maxwell Frost. This change will significantly impede efforts to protect conservatives and protect and conserve our nation's threatened and endangered species of fish, wildlife, and plants, the letter said. Among the species that the ESA has saved from extinction since it was signed into law in 1973 are the Florida panther, the manatee, and the American crocodile, and the hawksbill sea turtle. The rule change directly threatens the unique habitats that support the plants and animals for which the state is renowned, the Democrats wrote. Climate change, coupled with unprecedented urban growth in Florida and around the nation, has pushed our wildlife to the brink. This rule was significantly weaken the ESA and usher in an often irreversible loss of habitat, hastening the extinction of plants and animals that are a vital part of our state's culture and tourism economy. Burgum has said that the changes are common sense moves to eliminate red tape and restore landowners' property rights. For years, federal agencies abused the ESA to obstruct lawful and use and lawful land use and burden American families and businesses, Burgum said in a family in a statement. That approach turned routine activity into a regulatory trap, drove up costs, and impacted people's lives and expanded federal authority beyond what Congress intended. This action restores common sense, respects private property, proves much needed uncertainty, provides much needed certainty for landowners, and follows the statutes Congress actually passed. The rule change is scheduled to take effect September 14th. Two other ESA rollbacks would end automatic protections for newly listed threatened species, such as those on the brink of endangered status, and give more weight to economic factors when considering critical habitat designations. Coalition of environmental groups filed a lawsuit earlier this month challenging the harm. FPNL is planning to announce a deal for an AI data center before the end of the year. As controversy continues in Florida and nationally about energy-hungry data centers, Florida Power and Light expects to announce a deal on a project by the end of the year. Details were not disclosed last week during a quarterly earnings call with analysts, but John Ketchum, Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer of Net Era Energy, FPNL's parent company, said officials continue to see a lot of interest in Florida and feel good about our ability to announce a large load transaction there by the end of the year. Rapid growth in artificial intelligence and other data-intensive technology has driven a surge in the development of hyperscale data centers in other parts of the country. While Florida does not have such facilities, leaders in some communities have placed moratoriums on possible projects because of public opposition. FPNL President and CEO Scott Boras said during the call that it's important to find the right locations and have transparency in the process. I think there's a lot of spots in the state of Florida, and we are working with those communities that are really interested and have good locations that would be perfect hosts for data centers, Boras said. Governor Ron DeSantis, who has been critical of data centers and artificial intelligence, signed a law in May that is designed to shield residents and businesses from facing higher electric bills because of the costs of providing electricity to data centers. In part, the law focuses on tariffs, which would help define the structure and rates that determine how much customers are charged for electricity. The minimum tariff and service requirements must reasonably ensure that each large load customer bears its own full cost of service and that such cost is not shifted to the general body of tax ratepayers, the law said. Such cost of service includes, but is not limited to, connection, incremental transmission, incremental generation, and other infrastructure costs, operations and maintenance expenses, and any other costs required to serve a large load customer. The Florida Public Service Commission in November approved a broad FPNL rate settlement that addressed data center electricity use. Ketchum said it was designed to protect existing customers and that the new law, Senate Bill 484, codified many aspects of FPNL's large load tariff into law. Having that legislature come into place in May allows for a lot of certainty for those data center customers who are going to make a multi-billion-dollar investment in the state of Florida. So I think that gives us a good foundation to build on, Boras said. An initial test of the law will come next month when the Public Service Commission holds a hearing on a proposal by Duke Energy Florida. The proposal does not address specific data center projects, but would create a framework for how the company would address rates and other issues. The State Office of Public Counsel, which is designated by law to represent consumers in utility cases, in the group of Florida Rising, have contended that the Duke proposal does not meet the requirements of the law because it does not include a rate structure for data centers. Duke said it would use existing rate structure until the issue can be addressed in a broader rate case. The commission this month rejected a request by the Office of Public Counsel in Florida Rising to dismiss the proposal. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Trump is pushing the Supreme Court to overrule a lower court's ruling, rejecting his power to change mail-in ballot rules. President Donald Trump's administration asked the U.S. Supreme Court this week to allow implementation nationwide of his executive order aimed at tightening rules for mail-in voting ahead of the November 3rd midterm elections that will decide control of Congress. In a filing, the Justice Department requested that the justices put on hold a judge's ruling preventing the enforcement of the Republican president's directive in 23 mostly Democratic governed states in Washington, D.C., which had challenged the order as unconstitutional while the litigation plays out. The Supreme Court ordered those states to respond to the Justice Department's request by August 3rd. U.S. District Judge Indira Tawani rejected the administration's argument that the states lacked the necessary legal standing to challenge Trump's directive. In June, Tawani ruled that the president lacked authority to order changes in how states administer federal elections, noting that under the U.S. Constitution, states have the role of determining voter eligibility requirements. The administration said that the justices should lift Tawani's ruling because the lawsuit is premature. Federal agencies are still deliberating over how, if all, to implement the order, yet the district court preemptively decided that whatever the agencies may choose to do will necessarily be unlawful, the Justice Department said in a filing. Trump's executive order issued in March is part of a wider effort to make changes to elections. Trump, who has made false claims of widespread voter fraud, including his 2020 loss to Democrat Joe Biden, has pressed the Republican-controlled Congress to pass a contentious package of voter restrictions called the Save America Act. Trump has vowed to end use of mail-in ballots nationwide before the midterms and has long cast doubt on the security of such ballots, although evidence of voter fraud is rare. Restricting mail-in ballots would stand to disproportionately benefit Republicans, given that Democratic voters traditionally have been more likely to use mail-in ballots than Republican voters. Trump's executive order directed the Department of Homeland Security to comply and transmit to states a list of U.S. citizens eligible to vote in each state, and the Justice Department to prioritize investigating and prosecuting state and local election officials who issue ballots to people deemed not eligible to vote in federal elections. It also required the U.S. Postal Service to deliver ballots only to voters on each state's approved mail-in ballot list. The Postal Service recently moved to implement Trump's directive. States including California and Massachusetts sued in federal court in Boston to challenge Trump's order. A group of 12 Republican state attorneys general intervened in the case to defend Trump's directive. Tawani found that the claims made by the challenging states were not premature, as the administration had argued, and that they had legal standing to sue over Trump's directive because they would face election administration disruption, compliance costs, and credible threat of criminal prosecution. The judge also noted that the federal agencies lacked the ability to compile accurate citizen lists for each state. The Justice Department asked the Boston-based First U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to put Talwani's ruling on hold, based on the administration's view that the challengers lacked standing to sue. The First Circuit rejected the request on July 25th. In June, the Supreme Court rejected a Republican-backed challenge to state laws that would allow mail-in ballots received after Election Day to be counted. Disorganized dismantling of USAID is showing its flaws. The U.S. State Department's hurried takeover of aid programs from the shuttered U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, last year was hampered by staffing shortages, IT issues, and delayed guidance, an international watchdog said in a report released this week. President Donald Trump ordered the closure of USAID shortly after returning to office in January 2025. Well over 10,000 people were fired and thousands of programs canceled, throwing into turmoil U.S.-funded aid operations on which millions of the world's poorest people depended. The State Department's Office of Inspector General said that its report that aid projects carrying $51.5 billion in obligated funds were transferred just as the department was undergoing its own reorganization. The so-called green list of awards that survived the shutdown of USAID comprised 1,504 aid awards, including projects in conflict zones like Ukraine, Israel, and the Palestinian territories, it said. The transition happened extremely fast with evolving guidance. The Office of Inspector General cited officials from one bureau saying the report found that the department had not implemented the Inspector General's earlier recommendation aimed at smoothing the transition. The department's top office for management told authors that the implementation of the watchdog recommendation was underway, the report said. The State Department official responding to the report on a condition of anonymity did not address the specific findings, but said the Inspector General made friendly recommendations but did not find deficiencies in the new reorganization led by the Trump administration. Projects transferred from USAID have been replaced with new models such as bilateral health agreements and targeted funding through the UN's Humanitarian Aid Agency, the official said. 1 year into America First foreign assistance, our assistance is more agile, quicker to respond, and more accountable to the American taxpayer, the official said. About a third of the State Department's offices that had to take on USAID awards had no prior experience managing foreign assistance projects, staff told the watchdog. Department hired 838 new positions to administer the awards, but this was far fewer than the bureaus requested, the Office of Inspector General found. Guidance on how to update the terms of the aid awards was not fully in place until December, and an artificial intelligence-driven data management tool introduced to help the transition was beset by data problems, the report said. The continent with the largest number of different awards transferred to the State Department was Africa, with 639 awards carrying $17 billion of obligated funds. The Bureau of African Affairs, which took on the majority of those awards, requested 732 new positions to administer the awards, but ultimately only hired 232 people. The vast majority of them locally employed staff based out of U.S. missions. Florida police are the latest group to oppose Amendment 3. The Florida chapter of the Fraternal Order of Police is the latest public safety organization to oppose Amendment 3, the proposed constitutional amendment designed to provide property tax relief to homeowners, but which critics allege could radically reduce revenues for local government essential services, including public safety. The Florida State Fraternal Order of Police believes Florida taxpayers deserve meaningful property tax relief, the organization said in a written statement last week. We understand the financial pressures facing homeowners, and we support thoughtful and responsible reforms that provide relief while protecting the essential services our communities depend on. However, we oppose the current Amendment 3 because it creates far too much uncertainty about how local governments could continue to fund law enforcement, fire rescue, emergency medical services, and other critical public safety functions. Public safety should never become collateral damage with uncertain fiscal consequences. If approved, the proposed amendment would increase homestead exemptions for Floridians who own primary residence by the end of this year to $150,000 in 2027 and $250,000 in 2028. Further increases would be tied to the Consumer Price Index. The amendment would cap assessment increases on other property to 5% a year. Last week, the Florida Fire Chief Association became the first major statewide public safety organization to formally oppose Amendment 3, saying providing tax relief and reliable emergency services are not mutually exclusive, but both require responsible long-term planning. According to state economists, the proposed amendment would reduce local government property tax revenues by an estimated $5 billion in its first year and $11.8 billion per year after 5 years. The Florida Democratic Party announced its opposition to the measure earlier this week, while the Republican Party of Florida has yet to take a public stance. Governor Ron DeSantis campaigned on providing major property tax reduction for homestead property owners over the past year, but didn't unveil his own plan until less than a week before he called the Florida legislature to convene for a special session in June. After it was approved with some changes to his plan, he said that while he will vote yes on the amendment, he is not as enthused about it and will not head any political group championing the measure. That's a noticeable difference from 2024 when he formed a political committee and actively campaigned against proposed constitutional amendments that would have legalized recreational cannabis and enshrined abortion rights into the Florida Constitution. Once again, the president betrays his lack of compassion for the financial plight of average Americans by crowing about the purchase of luxury vehicles for his motorcade. President Donald Trump told a crowd in Michigan that the White House has ordered 250 Cadillac Escalades, the flagship sport utility vehicle in the luxury auto brand's lineup, for his presidential motorcade. Trump revealed the purchase in a speech delivered at General Motors testing facility in the Detroit suburb of Milford. The one and only Escalade, he said, toward the beginning of the roughly one-hour address. You know, we ordered, I think, 250 Escalades, right? We ordered 250 Escalades. We look sharp in those Escalades. The 2026 Escalade has a manufacturer's suggested retail starting price in the low 90,000s, though upgrades take it well north of six figures. Its high-performance V-Series runs about $170,000. Our guys are very spoiled, he said. They're very spoiled. They like the Escalade. So do I. Endorsement of the Escalade, introduced in 1998 by hip-hop artists and in the pop culture in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, helped reshape its image as status symbol and change Cadillac's reputation as a car for older generations, according to the History of Car posted by Al Ghandi Auto. It appears in a Jay-Z music video and in a freeway chase scene of The Matrix Reloaded. Cadillac, the preferred brand of many previous presidential administrations, also produces Trump's presidential limousine, a custom-built, highly secure fortress on wheels known as the Beast, according to the automaker. In his speech, the president praised Chevrolet Silverado, GMC Sierra, and the world-famous Hummer is some of America's most iconic vehicles. Thank you to the auto workers, the technicians, the mechanics, the welders, the engineers at General Motors, he said. There's no finer group of people. It was workers like you that built this country, and now it's men and women like you who are making it bigger, better, richer, stronger than ever before. General Motors, based in Detroit, recently reported stronger than expected second quarter results, despite a 31% net drop in income, citing strong American support for the company's pickups and SUVs. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my interview with Manny Ramirez, co-chair of the Tampa chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm happy to welcome Manny Ramirez, a co-chair of the Tampa chapter of Democratic Socialists of America, who are the largest socialist organization in the United States with over 100,000 members and chapters in all 50 states, and believe that working people should run both the economy and society democratically to meet human needs, not to make profits for the few. How you doing, Manny? Thanks for coming on.
Lou, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on.
You know, hey, first, you know, just tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, why you identify as a Democratic Socialist and how you got hooked up with these guys.
Yeah, so I grew up in Tampa. I'm local here, lived here most of my life. I've been a member of Tampa DSA for almost 3 years now. And DSA has been on my radar for a while. Like many people who become familiar with DSA, they hear about it, they think about it, and then eventually, like myself, I went out to a meeting, met the other members, got a deeper understanding of the organization and the work we do, and then, you know, couldn't turn back from there, because it became very clear to me that DSA was a serious organization that was serious about making the world a better place. And so now I am the co-chair of Tampa DSA. We are a chapter of now over 350 people. And that's one of many chapters across the country. We have chapters in every single state. We actually, since the 4th of July, funny enough, have over 120,000 members nationwide. So that has made us officially, by raw numbers, the largest socialist organization in U.S. history.
Yeah. And how's the Tampa chapter doing? Are you growing?
We're definitely growing. Yes, we are definitely growing. We have had many members join this year especially. Our chapter is about 10 years old or so, and we have folks from all over the Hillsborough County area joining us. We are, like all other DSA chapters, a chapter of everyday people. You know, we are healthcare workers, we are teachers, we are airport workers, we are Amazon warehouse workers, and we all come together not only to talk about politics, but do politics, to organize together to make our local communities better, but also to fight for the future that we want to build. Like you kind of referenced earlier, right? A strong thing for us is, as socialists, we recognize that capitalism is the system that is the source of most, if not all, injustice in the world. And so for us, in our analysis, that means we have to build to create a different political economic system, because capitalism at its heart is driven towards profit. And that profit comes at the expense of the vast majority of us and comes at the expense of the planet. Right. So even when if we get into talking about the climate crisis, that's, of course, directly tied to this dominant political economic system of capitalism that we have.
Yeah. You know, I mean, before we get on the air, you know, you mentioned that you listen to WMNF. So I'm sure, you know who Richard Wolff is, right?
Richard Wolff, the economist?
Yeah, economist, Richard Wolff.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has a show on M&F, and actually I had him on my show a while ago. But one of the great things that I heard from him is how the capitalist system is overstayed its welcome, and that we are going to be moving into an area or a type of economic system that's different. It's going to be co-ops, because the capitalist system, as he accurately points out, makes it where the least democratic place you are is the one where you spend the most time at work.
Because
if you work for a big corporation, you're a worker. The guys that are calling the shots are all in the boardroom, and they're all making decisions based on what's good for them and not necessarily what's good for everybody else. So,
I think that's exactly right, right? And that's kind of at the heart of our mission in DSA is, recognizing that capitalism is actually inherently an undemocratic system, for those reasons you're alluding to. We hear a lot of myths regarding capitalism, such as capitalism lends to competition. But we see that less and less, right? We're seeing wealth concentrated more and more in fewer hands. We're seeing every single industry being monopolized, right, if it hasn't been already. If you even think about, we're, of course, on here community radio, we're talking about media. If we think about corporate media, we're seeing that constantly being consolidated more and more and more. So capitalism does not breed healthy competition, actually. And because of all these things, capitalism lends to the erosion of democracy. When someone like Elon Musk, can spend hundreds of millions of dollars in our elections and also other elections around the world, when we have, corporations and these super PACs spending this countless money on our elections, what we have is a serious problem of bought out politicians who are not serving our interests. And so that's a huge issue. And for us, we make sure to say that issue is directly tied to our political economic system, one that we can change. Capitalism is not eternal. Capitalism is about, 500 years old or so. And so it is fairly new to human history, and it certainly can, and I would say will change.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. I have to go back to Richard Wolff noted that there was a time when the economic system was basically slavery, okay, and then that got kind of worn out and it became serfs. And then that got worn out, and we got into capitalism where they were like workers, but that's reaching its end too, where workers have to have more of a say, according to Mr. Wolff. I'll tell you what though, for a long time, it seemed like the only recognizable democratic socialist holding office in this country was Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
But then Soren Mondani was elected mayor of New York in spite of big bucks back in his opponents and even bigger lies about how he was going to ruin the city. Well, that success apparently has Republicans again, and this is nothing new, painting socialists as communists, a misconception I know Bernie's battled like since forever. Please, for once, let's set the record straight, at least for now. What's the difference? Democratic socialists are not the communists that they're alluding to, right?
Right, and so all I say is that this is nothing new, right? When we talk about the fear-mongering, the demonizing that we face as democratic socialists or any socialist group in this country, right, we can think back to McCarthyism, we can think back to all the various red scares we've seen in this country, right? And so, and there's a reason why we see that happen, and especially perpetrated in, dominant corporate media, right? It's because these narratives that we all must be scared of these, scary reds, right, is to, defend the status quo, to defend the system of capitalism and to defend the interests of the billionaire class. And so, you know, but more and more people are seeing through those lies because it's just very transparent, right? You know, people are waking up every day realizing that our country and of course, you know, globally, there is this immense inequality, you know, and if we just zero in right now in our own economy in the U.S., we of course are seeing prices skyrocket, whether it be gas, groceries, rent, et cetera, despite all these promises from our politicians, including the Trump administration, right? We're told time and time again that they're going to be the ones to deliver affordability. Yet, it is really the folks like Zohran, the Democratic Socialists, who are actually making those gains, even despite the pushback, right? Because Zohran is not necessarily in the friendliest of spaces, maybe friendlier than compared to Florida, we can say for sure. But, you know, when folks stop, you know, when folks can get past all the fear-mongering, all the demonizing, all the labels, and, for example, take a look at our DSA program. If you go to Workers Deserve More and you read through our DSA program, you can see that these are popular policies. They're policies that make sense because they're policies that are about human need, not corporate greed.
Exactly. You know, it's not this fear that somebody's going to, you know, the government's going to come in. If you get a communist in government, they're going to take away their house. Nobody's talking about taking away your property. You can have private property all you want. It's just to level the playing field. What are some of the key policy positions though of DSA nationally, and I would assume with the Tampa chapter?
Yeah, for sure. Happy to talk about that. So, you know, interestingly enough, like just a couple of weeks ago, we actually announced our new program. So there was a few updates we made to our program, but some of the key stuff there is things like universal health care, right? We still have private insurance and we have millions of people uninsured, unable to afford to go to the doctor. You know, medical debt is actually the number one source of debt in this country. And it doesn't have to be that way, right? There's most of the comparable countries to the U.S. and the world have universal healthcare systems. So healthcare for all is central to us. We also talk about housing for all. Housing is a right. It shouldn't be a privilege. It shouldn't be something that anyone worries about. You know, we can talk about war and genocide, right? DSA stands proudly for a free Palestine. We stand proudly against any war anywhere that not only is causing death and destruction abroad, right, but is taking our tax dollars to do that, tax dollars that we can easily instead spend on building universal health care, having college for all, having housing, as I said, right? So, again, these things, when you really read through our program, folks can cut through all the noise. Cut through all the demonization, and see that what DSA is about, what socialism is about building a world that meets our needs and that is truly democratic, right? Because that is at the heart of our mission. We know that if we put workers, the vast majority of people, at the heart of politics, at the heart of it all, that we can run things the right way, because we strongly believe that those who make society run, the workers should be the ones who run society.
Yeah, I just want to interrupt for a second for people just tuning in. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Manny Ramirez, co-chair of the Tampa chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Interesting that you mentioned, you know, healthcare and health debt. You know, I did see on your website that, you know, you guys managed to, you know, erase nearly $3 million worth of, medical debt for, you know, a bunch of folks up in Hillsborough County. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to. Yeah, we were really excited about this. So, DSA chapters around the country, right? Of course, electing folks is a big part of our mission, but we also do all kinds of different campaigns, different issue campaigns. So, for example, Pinellas DSA right now is having an awesome campaign to fight for public power and to do away with Duke Energy. And a campaign we did in Tampa this year was this medical debt campaign. And so what we wanted to do was make a real material impact in our community while also talking about the importance of pushing for universal health care. So what we ended up doing was we did a lot of groundwork, a lot of fundraising to raise $10,000. And we partnered with a nonprofit called Undo, which basically what they do is the back-end work of buying up debt. So they have a lot of debt lawyers and experts in their team. And so essentially they buy up this debt, and then rather than continuing to charge it, right, to expect the payment, they just cancel it, right? And so over 2,400 residents in Hillsborough County received a letter saying that Tampa DSA helped cancel their medical debt. And like you mentioned, it was almost $3 million of medical debt we were able to cancel. So we were really excited about that. And the success we had with that campaign, and it was a success that came from our members. You know, it's, again, a group of everyday people. We had folks that worked in every different aspect of the healthcare industry. We have folks that work in libraries and schools, et cetera, coming together. You know, first things first, we democratically decided to do this campaign. So we voted as a chapter, and then we planned it, and we carried it out, and we did it. And so, and as always, we're also talking about the core issues, right? So not just canceling this debt, but talking about how, what is the source of this debt? You know, if we had universal health care in this country, medical debt wouldn't be an issue. And that's ultimately what we need to do to fully eradicate that problem. And to talk a little bit more about the other work we have going on right now, we actually did just recently endorse Ashley Herman, who is a candidate running for Florida State House District 69. Ashley has been a member since 2024, and she's fighting for policies that, you know, sustain and protect our communities, right, like any other DSA candidate. So she's fighting for renter protections, funding public transit, paid family leave, workers' rights, and, you know, so many other things, including fighting back against data centers, which is obviously a huge, huge issue right now. So we're really excited to endorse Ashley Herman, our member of DSA, and hopefully get a win here in November in Florida.
Yeah, that would be great, because Florida, you know, Florida could use a little more blue in the legislature, that's for sure. You know, I mean, are there, like, you know, well, see, this is the thing, too. People that aren't, like, of like, working age, like I alluded, I'm retired, you know, but I do have a son who's in his early 30s who's got a child. And like, child care and health care and all these issues are huge for working people. And as you mentioned, the wealth inequity, that still blows my mind. I mean, the numbers are just absurd. You know, that there's what, like 400 people that control more than half the wealth in the country. You know, and we divide the rest. I mean, how is that sustainable?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so literally the top 10% own 2/3 of the wealth. And that's massive. Yeah. That's massive. And that's pretty much been growing since the 70s, especially. And I mean, even under COVID, right? A time where we should have been coming together and taking care of each other, as many of us did, we were also failed by our governments. You know, and those politicians controlled by these corporations. And so during that time of COVID, inequality grew even faster, right? And unfortunately, we're still facing that problem today. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, in times of growing inequality, though, you know, myself as a democratic socialist being part of DSA, I have grown immensely hopeful even during these dark times, because I'm able to wake up every day and join side by side with other workers and community members around Tampa and fight for something better that I know is possible, because history tells us it's possible. You know, when even kind of going back to the fear-mongering a little bit, right, when we think about all the major social and economic gains for ordinary people in the U.S. in the past century or so, things like civil rights, things like different environmental gains and regulations, the New Deal, all of these things were won by organized people coming together and getting organized. But before they were won, all these same people were demonized one way or another, whether being called communists or whatever it may, or terrorists, right? We can also talk about that word terrorist being thrown against us. But again, you know, the more we look at history, the more I think we can see that even in these dark times, even in these times where, you know, there's a lot stacked up against us, we are the majority. And when we unite and come together and fight for this world that we know we can build, we can do it.
Well, that's kind of the point, you know, what you had mentioned, you know, about you know, some programs like, you know, civil rights legislation and the New Deal. You know, there was a time in this country when government saw its role, part of its role, as sort of regulating big business, making sure that the playing field was even, and that people got a square deal, you know. And then suddenly, that, like you say, in the 70s, that started to dissipate. So I have to believe that the real solution to these problems is electorally. You know, you got to get the right people in government to make the kinds of moves that are going to be able to help people, like for instance, having some sort of wealth tax. You know, I mean, that would be, you know,
we certainly need that. And I'll add on to that too, and I'll use Zohran as an example, right? You know, DSA, we run candidates, and we certainly think that putting the right people in electoral positions matters, and it makes a difference, 100%. But also, we need a movement behind that. Without a movement, any politician can be bought. Any politician can be swayed and coerced. We need a mass movement of people. And I think the Zohran example shows that a little bit, right? Their campaign, you know, I think we hear a lot about Zohran and his social media campaign and how great it was, how flashy it was, how successful it was. And that's certainly true. Durf definitely played a big part in his success. But even his social media, I mean, that came from a big team of people coming together to make that work. But beyond that, right, they had tens of thousands of volunteers they were able to get together and door knock, right? And not to mention the thousands and thousands of DSA members who came together to organize that campaign and put it together and made it a real independent grassroots campaign. And now we see Zohran in office, and it seems like every other day he's coming out with a new announcement. He just announced his community grocery stores and one in each borough just recently. And these are things they're not happening just because Zohran is charismatic and such a great organizer and leader, but it's because New York City was able to get together thousands and thousands of people and help elect him, but also push the others around him to get these policies in motion. Because we have to remember, again, I mentioned earlier, Zohran isn't, you know, of course we're having more of these victories, and hopefully we'll have even more DSA members in those positions up there in New York, and that will help a ton. But there's still a lot of folks who are against Zohran. But because he has such massive backing, and not just support, mind you, but people on the ground every day organizing, that is essential to those victories. And so when we think about replicating that across the country, whether that be in any state, in Tampa, in Sarasota, et cetera, you know, we believe that it takes a mass movement to win.
It absolutely does, you know, having experience, you know, working on the Barack Obama campaigns, and then seeing what happened when Hillary Clinton ran, you know, the movement wasn't there, you know, and you know, the organization wasn't there, and so that's kind of why she lost, you know, from what I could see. And so, yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, it's more than just finding the right candidates and having them elected. To be able to do that, you know, you have to have a group, and DSA is doing their work, right? I mean, that's
we're doing our best. We're doing our best, and that's why I invite all your listeners, go to program.dsausa.org, read our program, and consider joining DSA. In Sarasota, there's a little bit of work to do to form a chapter there, but we've certainly had a lot of people reaching out to us asking how to start a chapter. If you're a listener and you're thinking that same thing, reach out to us. You can email us at dsa.tampa@gmail.com. Whatever you need, we can help start a chapter. But even if you don't have a local chapter, you can join DSA and support in all kinds of ways. So really encourage folks to check us out and consider how you can join DSA.
Beautiful. You know, on that note, you know, I really want to thank you, Manny Ramirez, co-chair of the Tampa DSA chapter, you know, for coming on with me today and letting some people know about the great stuff you're doing and what else needs to be done. Thanks again, Manny. You have a great afternoon.
Thank you so much, Lou. Appreciate you. Have a great one.
Right. Bye now.
Carl Gunn, 77, was concerned for his privacy when he spotted a camera outside his St. Petersburg neighborhood of Coquina Key mounted on a 12-foot black pole. Gunn later learned that the device was operated by a private for-profit company and that it automatically loads license plates and AI-generated profiles of each passing car into a massive database. The only 12-foot pole Gunn had was his pool skimmer. He taped a sign to it, grabbed a camping chair, and sat himself in front of the camera. This Saturday, all the camera saw was Gunn's sign, "Down with Flock Cameras." "This is just another thing to take our information and spy on us," Gunn told Creative Loafing, Tampa Bay. "I have a constitutional right to my privacy. I'm a law-abiding citizen, and I don't need anyone sticking their nose in my business. And if they do, I'm going to chop it off." This was Gunn's second protest against Flock Cameras, his first being a week prior at a camera a few blocks away. CL interviewed Gunn as he sat under the sun with a sign and watched the public reaction to his protest. Gunn was eventually joined by a supportive stranger who brought him a shade umbrella and a cold soda. Passing drivers honked in support, and one even dropped off cold drinks and snacks out of her passenger window. Gunn told CL that officers and two St. Petersburg police cruisers stopped by to question him for about 10 to 15 minutes before driving off. Footage shared with CL appears to show two cruisers stopped in the road beside Gunn as the driver taking the videos shouts, "Yo, what's your name? I'll come bail you out." Flock Cameras are run by a private company and have been in St. Petersburg since 2022. The St. Petersburg Police Department has said that the cameras help solve crimes. Civil liberties organizations and bipartisan lawmakers say Flock Cameras are an unprecedented mass surveillance tool that could change the landscape of personal freedom nationwide. Like any security camera, Flock Cameras collect video evidence constantly. Unlike other cameras, they automatically read each license plate, collect every detail about the scene through AI, and put it all in a searchable database. A police officer can search 100,000 cameras nationwide to see if a fugitive has passed any Flock Cameras or get an alert when they do. They can also search for identifying features like make, model, color, or even unique dents and bumper stickers. Police can also use the cameras to surveil protesters and StockX lovers, or strangers they find attractive. The cameras have raised questions on constitutionality and have led to wrongful arrests across the country. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Thanks to Manny Ramirez for joining us this week, and stay tuned for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.